listening to Scopes Monkey Choir.
Scopes Monkey Choir.
Episode
78.
78?
The podcast where music and sound meet science and skepticism.
Oh yeah, I always cut you off before you can do the subtitle.
Well, yeah, which we still haven't put in our theme song, though I did take out, I finally took out the old subtitle from the theme song.
Oh, yeah, we gotta get Joe back in here.
Yeah, we gotta get Joe back. So yeah, talk about a couple things here. What are we gonna start with?
Well, how about we read a letter, an email from a listener?
Ah, yes.
This is from a listener who heard podcast 74, in which we spoke about the universe of sound installation at the Science Museum in London. We talked about when we were in London and we failed to go to this exhibit. So this listener had business in London and she went to the exhibit because she's interested in music. And
she very kindly sent us a nice little report.
Yeah, she sent us a quite extensive report. And I won't read the whole thing, but I thought I would let you know. I thought I would read a little bit from it because it's kind of fun. And I want to say, first of all, that she thought the exhibit was really cool. And she talked about a bunch of the interactive things that you can do. And very nicely, the fact that there is a live musician there. They try to have a live musician from the London Philharmonic there every day to play along with themselves. So they're in the video and they're also there to talk to you about the filming of it and to play live. They apparently play live along with the recording.
Nice.
So let me read you what Linda, our listener, said about the virtual conducting experience. I have to say, the SciTech Today article totally overrated the virtual conducting experience, and it was not as interactive as they made it sound. I was really looking forward to making the orchestra fall to pieces under my baton, but that's not how it worked. There were three modes. One, you follow the hand movements on screen to follow the beat. Your arm starts to ache, and you realize how hard the conductor's job is.
Mm.
Two, you do the hand movements following the beat and get a polite coughing sound if you get it wrong, but the music just plays at the same tempo. It doesn't follow what you're doing. Now, I'd like to interject here that that's usually what happens to conductors with big orchestras as well, so maybe it's a real experience. But going on. In this mode, your left hand is supposed to control volume, but I honestly couldn't hear any difference. I don't know if that's because the whole installation was drowning out the sounds from the speakers in the conducting booth. So apparently it's a big, it's a huge
exhibition.
That's
always one of the problems with collections of sound installations together.
Yes, indeed.
It's the cacophony that ensues.
Yeah. And number three, psychedelic swirly things go across the screen following your right hand and your left hand changes the color of them.
Mm.
The school kids appeared to like this one best.
Right. Well, ultimately, these things are all for the kids.
Yes, they are. But she had a great time. She said she spent 3 hours there.
Cool. Yeah. So the virtual conducting not being too impressive is just a minor thing. She recommends the whole thing.
And it sounds like they have recordings of the entire Holst cycle, all the planets.
Mm-hmm.
And along with a new piece by another composer. In fact, she was very nicely sent us a bunch of links, which we will post on
the show page.
Thanks
so much, Linda.
Thank you,
very
Linda.
Very appreciated.
I'm really glad you enjoyed it, too.
Yeah.
Oh, and entry is free. Hooray, London.
Yeah, they're always doing free over there. And
plus, there are a great many other fantastic exhibits at the Science Museum.
Yeah.
Which, and it's free.
I can't believe we didn't go to the Science Museum.
We're going to have to go back to London.
Yeah.
Is that free?
That is free, yes. Yes. Free for... No, it's not free. Her also comment about conducting, about how it's physically challenging, is one of those things that, of course, most people don't think about, that actually waving your arm is really can be really... that conducting is very physical. And it just... It reminded me of a good friend of mine's father is a puppeteer, was actually one of the Muppets back in the day. And I asked him once, you know, it was basically like, you know, what's it like being a puppeteer? And he handed me a book and he said, hold that above your head. And I was like, okay. And I held it above my head and he said, all right, I'll come back in 6 hours. You tell me what you think about puppeteering.
That was quite a digression into a charming anecdote. I have a slightly less digressing anecdote, which is that we went to see the New York Philharmonic concert at the Armory last night in New York. And of course, it will, even though it was on for two nights, it will be over by the time this podcast posts. But I just want to say that was an amazing concert. And if any of our listeners were there, I guess we're sharing now a moment of, wow, was that cool. It had four conductors at one point. They were doing, among other things, a Stockhausen piece that had three orchestras and a Boulez piece that had seven. So,
like, it's this giant, giant space, and there are, like, orchestras strewn about the room in different places, and these, so it's basically, we were talking about, it's like the 3D version of traditional concert going or something. It's sort of all over the place. It was cool.
And it was packed and sold out. Hooray, New York Philharmonic Stockhausen concert.
So, yeah, for those who don't know Stockhausen, he's a total freak. In addition,
it was
to,
an awesome piece.
No, it was. It was really, but I just, the reason that Haiting saying that is of interest is that it's like, basically selling out a huge room for what is essentially an avant-garde piece of music is very
unusual.
We'll
post a clip. We'll find a YouTube clip and post it so you all can experience it a little bit.
So, speaking of 19th century technology.
Technology?
Technology. Speaking of technology.
they didn't yet have the L in the 19th century.
That's right. The L wasn't invented until 1906. It was a result of the Einstein's equations that, no, never mind. So, astute listeners and people who know these things generally may recall that from our episode 26, where we talked about the phonautograph, which is an early recording technology. In that same episode, we very nicely had Patrick Feaster called in to describe that technology. Patrick Feaster is a scholar and early music recording technology expert and does all sorts of cool things. He has now done another cool thing. So, Emil Berliner is the inventor of the gramophone. And now the distinction between what Edison invented and what Berliner invented is that the gramophone used discs and was the first. He was the one who, he started with cylinders just like Edison, but then he switched. He made the switch to discs.
Because he was a jelly donut, of course.
Because he was a jelly, exactly, because he ist ein, yeah. And so he's the reason that the LP eventually, he basically started that angle of technology.
That looks like a jelly donut with a hole in the middle.
Exactly.
It makes perfect sense.
So now I want a jelly donut. And so he invented the gramophone disc idea. And Patrick Feaster came upon an 1890 magazine in which there was a photo, a big photo, of the first gramophone disc that Berliner recorded onto. Or what seems like it was the first. If it was not the first, it was definitely the first that we know of that had been lost. We do not have the disc anymore. So he came across a photograph of this disc, and it was actually a pretty large format photograph, pretty high quality. And he was like, ding. And he took a high-resolution scan of it and used his software and such, and he managed to reproduce the actual gramophone disc recording from the photograph.
What?
Isn't that awesome?
Patrick Feaster, you rock.
Yeah, Patrick Feaster rocks. Patrick Feaster,
if you're listening, thank you for listening to our podcast, first of all, and if you're listening, call in again and tell us about this, because this is amazing.
Totally amazing. Here's what it sounds like. A little bit.
Also, am Schlesien, am 21. Oktober 1889.
All right, who is that talking? Because he is ein Berliner.
Yeah, he is Emil Berliner.
Oh, he's an actual Berliner.
Yeah, that is Herr Berliner, and he is reciting Friedrich Schiller's ballad Der Handschuh.
Oh.
Which is glove, right?
Yes, it is. The ballad of the glove?
Apparently, yeah.
Maybe it's something about a duel. because you used to hit people with your gloves.
So anyway, that's Il Berliner himself reciting that thing, and that is the oldest disc recording that we know of,
retrieved from a photograph. That is incredible.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, you know, actually, that there's an odd sort of thematic segue into our next news item. Let's see if I can do this, which is optical, or no, it's not optical, that's the thing. It's sonic tweezers. It's another situation where the optical and the sonic are kind of, the barriers are being crossed. Because we know that there are... already microscopic tweezers that are made of lasers, where they sort of suspend molecules somehow using the properties of light and lasers, which I really don't understand.
No, I don't.
Okay. But, and I sort of understand this a little bit better, because these are, this is new, these are sonic tweezers. And basically what it is, I do not know who these scientists are who have done this. I failed to gather that bit of information, but we'll put it in the show notes. So it's basically a kind of surround sound setup. They have a microscopic little staging area where they put some molecules and even very small organisms like nematodes. And they surround them by four little... that kind of, they're sort of like speakers almost, but not quite. They're much smaller, more like tiny little gold tuning forks, little arrays of tuning forks.
Right. I mean, they're speakers in the sense that they emit sound, but they're not speakers. They're not the same technology.
No, not at all. In fact, they're much, much more like, although not quite, tuning forks, little arrays of tuning forks. And they kind of, they make waves, not in air. I don't even know if the, if there's a medium around the staging platform or not, but they say that they're surface acoustic waves. So they send a little signal along a surface, from the surrounding areas, down onto the surface of this little staging area. And, they can manipulate those sonic acoustic waves in such a way that they can move around a little, a molecule or a tiny, maybe not a molecule. They can't get as small as lasers, apparently, but but cells, they can move around, like blood cells, for instance. They've done cow blood cells, and they can move around nematodes. So they're basically kind of pushing them with little waves in different directions, but apparently they can do it in a really fine, coordinated way.
That's really interesting.
And, you know...
And I would assume that one of the advantages of this is that optical tweezers at that tiny level can actually cause damage, right?
To cells, yes, definitely. So they're very excited about this because they can use them on organisms and on organic matter.
Right.
Whereas, yes, lasers will damage cells like that. And these acoustic waves are fine enough that they are not fine enough, but have little enough energy that they don't damage cell membranes. And unfortunately, they said at the end of the reporting that they don't have extremely fine control quite yet, and that they are thinking about using higher frequencies to get finer control, but then they're worried about it damaging the organic material. But the scientists themselves were surprised at how much control they had, and especially that the fact that they could actually move living things like nematodes using these acoustic tweezers.
I'm a big fan of the word nematode.
Yeah, it's a good word.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No. Nematode. Feed a fever. No. Nematode.
Wow, you have just gone off somewhere I cannot.
I'm not fit for podcasting. I'm in no state of mind to.
What's next?
I have a hype alert.
A hype alert. We've had a lot of those recently. Last week's episode was just basically a bunch of hype alert.
Yeah, well, I mean, we could spend every single episode just talking about how science is reported badly. Because it is constantly. If you see a headline, there are a fair number of them out there right now talking about how dolphin-human communication has been achieved. Don't believe the hype. So, for instance, this is...
Nate said to me the other day, so long and thanks for all the fish, I was just
you were
dreaming.
Reading. You were reading a book.
Oh.
Yeah, still working on that distinction there. The headline I saw that drew me into this little morass was "Science says: human to dolphin conversation now possible."
Oh, I love how science is a character.
Yeah, exactly.
Science is some lady in a white robe holding
Or another one of Thor's brothers or something like that.
Science.
Yeah. So science has said, so, you know, you read into that and that, like that, you know, it talks a little bit, oh, we know that they're intelligent and that their communication goes beyond blah, 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 and all this stuff. So, but if you actually dig in and read some, what's really going on, here's what really is happening, is that there was just an acoustics meeting in Hong Kong. And
wait, the dolphins had an acoustics meeting?
Yeah, the dolphins had an acoustics meeting. There was a meeting of various acoustics engineers and scientists and blah, blah, blah in Hong Kong. And there was a team based at Tokyo University of Marine Science and Technology. And at this meeting, they unveiled their prototype for a dolphin speaker. Because here's the thing. Humans, as we've talked about before, can hear approximately from 20 hertz up to approximately 20,000 hertz. 20,000 hertz, oh, that's a lot of hertz. That's, you know, that's pretty high frequency, right? Not for a dolphin. Uh-uh. Dolphins can communicate, can hear and communicate up to approximately 150 kilohertz. 150,000 hertz, right?
Wow.
So they hear sounds way, 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 way higher than we can. And they use them to communicate as well. Good for them. So because of the limits of our listening, the average speaker, even the high-end speakers that human beings make to listen to their own music, they don't even remotely emit sounds that high. They don't. Why would they bother? You know, because we can't hear them. So these scientists, these marine biologists and technologists have developed a speaker that specifically that it can emit sounds from 7 hertz to 170 kilohertz. So within the range, the full range that dolphins use to communicate, and they developed it just to help research with dolphins. So now it's gonna.
So basically, anyone who speaks dolphin can record themselves and play it back to the dolphins.
Well, yeah, no, that's the thing, is that now it means when they record dolphins communicating, they now can play back sounds of dolphins communicating. It's going to help in research of trying to figure out what they're saying. So
right,
it is,
which means
it's interesting, but
trying to figure out what they're saying.
Right, exactly. It's actually, they invented a speaker to try to further research into trying to figure out what to, and to what extent dolphins are communicating.
Of course, CNN and Fox are still reporting that we are speaking to dolphins even now.
Of course. Oh,
because they didn't read the whole article.
You're going to get topical. We never get topical. We never get topical. Please ignore the topical humor.
Wait. So am I to understand that we have no problem recording? We have no problem recording those frequencies.
I cannot answer that question. If you take like a really high end marine microphone and use an off the shelf recording device, I have no idea. I'd have to look that up.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
But now we can admit it, whether or not.
But now we can admit it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, speaking of the recording industry, I have a random little study to report that was published quite recently, the title of which is Short-Term Exposure to Attractive and Muscular Singers in Music Video Clips Negatively Affects Men's Body Image and Mood. Okay, and this is, I don't know why this is remarkable. And it really doesn't have anything to do with music, except that it has the word music video in the title, which is, I think, why it came up on Google alerts.
Right, comes up on our searches.
Science about music. And it's just looking into the images that are shown on music videos. And I would have to say, of course, something that seems really obvious, but they... People have been doing research into this as it relates to women for ages and ages and ages, and they've only recently kind of started looking into these kind of body image issues for men.
And what a surprise, or maybe it is a surprise for some people, but in that what they're finding is the sort of backstory is that that men also are negatively affected. Their personal view of themselves, what is the term for that?
Yes.
Is negatively affected by being bombarded by idealized body images, right?
Yes. Although, usually for women, they look at whether the skinniness of the people that they see on the screens negatively affects their own body image. And in this case, they looked at the idealized muscularity of the images seen. And the things that they measured in the men were their mood, their body image, and their level of anger.
Huh.
And I don't know that the results were actually very conclusive, except to say that they definitely did have poorer body image, but there was some question about whether what is called their appearance schema activation,
right,
which is their interior image of themselves. I don't think that they know for sure whether they were actually starting to think of themselves differently, but they seem to get angry.
They seem to get angry
when they saw too many images of muscular men.
Yeah.
And as I say, they've been doing this for women for ages, and it has nothing to do with music. It's just about what you see while you're listening to the music. And they did controls where they showed the men landscapes, or they just played them music. And
so it seems like they did sort of similar studies that have been done before. They just specifically did it using music videos instead of just images or...
Yes, right, yes. And they played them with the music.
Yeah. Interesting. I wonder if they control for sexuality.
That
clearly, there must be a difference.
It was done on 90 men, so you've got to assume that 10% of them were gay.
Yeah.
I would say that the antidote to this is just to watch the video to "I'm Sexy and I Know It" over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that what that song is called?
I'm Too Sexy for My
I
Cat.
I Work Out. No, the one that we've been laughing about, called I think it's called "I'm Sexy and I Know It."
Yeah.
Girl, look at that body.
Oh,
I Work
yeah,
Out.
Yeah.
That one.
That's hilarious.
In which the video, you haven't seen the video, but I've been exposed to it at the gym, and it has this kind of like pot-bellied guy.
Oh, really?
Speedo.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, that's vaguely related, kind of, but maybe we should just get out of here.
I think we better stop talking. And
yeah, I'm hungry anyway. Thanks for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir from scopesmonkeychoir.com. We're musicians, not scientists. If you doubt something we've said, we're probably wrong. Look it up. Nevertheless, scopesmonkeychoir.com has references and citations. We love feedback.
Hey.
What?
We're going to TAM.
Oh, yeah. The amazing meeting. We are going to be
Las
there. Please
Vegas,
say hi.
Baby.
Wow,
was that me? I'm going to be talking on a panel.
Yeah. Yep.
We've already said that.
Yep.
I'm going to be at TAM, and so are you. Look for us. Turn off this podcast now.